Saying that, I will ask for your indulgence. I will read the short bibliography of biography of each of the speakers, because they all have a long, long history of research and many awards. I don't want to make any mistakes presenting them. Our first speaker today will be Dr. Susan Solomon, who will speak about stratospheric ozone depletion and some linkages and parallels to climate change. Dr. Solomon is widely recognized as one of the leaders in the field of atmospheric sciences. Since receiving her PhD degree in chemistry from the University of California at Berkeley in 1981, she's been employed at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration as a research scientist. Her scientific papers have provided not only key measurements, but also theoretical understanding regarding ozone destruction, especially the role of surface chemistry. In 1986 and 87, she served as head project scientist of the National Ozone Expedition at McMurdo Station, Antarctica, and made some of the first measurements there that pointed towards chlorofluorocarbons as the cause of the ozone hole. In 1994, an Antarctic glacier was named in her honor in recognition of that work. In March of 2000, she received the National Medal of Science, the United States' highest scientific honor, for key insight in explaining the cause of the Antarctic ozone hole. She is the recipient of many other honors and awards, including the highest awards of the American Geophysical Union, the Bowie Medal, the American Meteorological Society, the Rossby Medal, and the Geochemical Society, the Goldschmidt Medal.
Going to be here all day if you do all
this. No, I think you deserve it, because I read it during night and it's quite impressive, and I think it's worth we take a few seconds to present you in the correct way. I think you will notice this when she give a talk. But I will short it. don't be embarrassed. Okay, many distinction honors and awards, and also recipient of numerous honorary doctoral degrees in the U.S. and abroad. One more thing, she was named one of the year's 100 most influential people in Time magazine in 2008. She also received the Grande Medaille of the Academy of Sciences in Paris for her leadership in ozone and climate science in 2008, and the Volvo Environment Prize in 2009. As he requests me, I catch many, many very important prizes, and she is a member of many academies of sciences here in the U.S. and the Europe. And I give her the floor now for the speak.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that delightful introduction, and it's a great pleasure and an honor to be here. I must say that in the old days when people used view graphs, you could ask someone to come and tell them that they had 35 minutes to give their talk and then change it to 20 in real time, but it's going to be a little difficult to adjust, so I'll try to go quickly through the PowerPoint. What I want to do is to help in this celebration by telling you how unbelievably lucky I've been in my life regarding Antarctic ozone depletion and its role that it's played in my life and career. I'll talk a little bit about the Arctic versus the Antarctic, as I know that's a fundamental point of this meeting. I'll talk about something that you may not all be familiar with, how Montreal helped Kyoto, how the Montreal Protocol to protect the ozone layer has actually helped enormously to protect the climate as well in ways that you may not appreciate. If I have time, I'll spend a few minutes looking back at Antarctic history, it'll be clear if we have time to do that why I want to do it, and then I'll look a little bit ahead. I'll touch on a few points that are relevant for Copenhagen in the coming days. Well, very briefly, the reason that we're interested in ozone is because it protects life on the planet's surface from biologically damaging ultraviolet radiation, which anyone who's ever been sunburned knows how dangerous that can be. And, of course, it becomes very dangerous in light-skinned people because it can produce skin cancers. It can also produce cataracts in all people. It can also damage crops such as soybeans, and there's evidence that it can affect life even in the ocean. What it doesn't do is to warm up the planet. Ozone depletion is not the cause of climate change. And just want to make clear that there's a lot of public misunderstanding on that point. People imagine that because we have a hole in the ozone layer, it's somehow letting a lot of heat in, and that's very important. That actually is not significant. But the chlorofluorocarbons, which are the agents that are primarily responsible for the ozone hole, are also greenhouse gases. And that turns out to be quite important, as I'll tell you later. Well, back when I was a graduate student in 1977, beginning my studies of the ozone layer, the view was that if we kept using chlorofluorocarbons at the rates that we were doing it back then, that in perhaps 100 years we might see a 5% or maybe as much as a 10% depletion of the ozone layer worldwide. It was a long time away. It was only a theory. It was had not been observed. At the time, the CFCs were used in spray cans, insulating foams, refrigeration, air conditioning, solvents, many, many different kinds of applications. In 1985, the British Antarctic Survey shocked the world by announcing that they had found a tremendous depletion of ozone. It was not 5 to 10% a century from now, but it was half of the ozone being gone at that time, and in the world's most unlikely place, Antarctica, where no one ever expected to see these kinds of changes. Well, the ozone hole has become a tremendous icon, I think, of the story of science, the story of Antarctic science in the 20th century. There's the British record. And just reflecting on my own life, how lucky I was that I was prepared to begin working on this field just as the ozone hole was beginning to open up. I was lucky, but what I tell young students today is that they don't have to be lucky. They can be smart. Climate is going to change. We know it's going to change. And they will live through in the next 20 to 30 years of a typical scientific career, maybe 40 or 50 if they're really lucky. You can imagine how much this planet is going to change and how many different things will occur, how much of an exciting scientific period that will be to be part of. Well, the British data, of course, were quickly confirmed by the Japanese and by the American stations and by the satellite records that provide these lovely pictures. So there's no doubt that in October over Antarctica today, there is about half as much ozone as there used to be. And I'll talk more about that later. Well, the reason why this happens is something that I became quite interested in, and I had the good fortune to identify the key reaction, which is the one down there in the corner. It's a surface chemical process that occurs because Antarctica really is the coldest place on Earth. It's so cold that clouds can form in the Antarctic stratosphere. That changes the chemistry from being gas phase only to being much more effective at depleting ozone, as I'll show you in a minute. One of the things that occurred for me was that I became quite interested in who had seen these clouds first, because they are quite spectacular. Anyone who's ever been to Antarctica in the winter knows how beautiful they are to look at. So I started looking at some of the diaries of the early explorers. Robert Falcon Scott certainly has a diary entry where he had seen, without doubt, a polar stratospheric cloud in August of 1911. If I have time, I'll talk about some observations that Arctowski made in 1898. I believe Arctowski is probably the first documented example of someone having seen a polar stratospheric cloud. But I wouldn't be surprised if Bellingshausen saw them, and so perhaps someone can enlighten me if they found an example of that. Why are these clouds so important? Well, you need cold temperatures to have the clouds there. You also need sunlight, and when you have those two conditions, the molecules that I've indicated over there on the right-hand side of this slide, hydrochloric acid and chlorine nitrate, which are inert towards ozone, those molecules can team up together on the surface of a cloud. They don't react in the gas phase, but on a surface they can get together, making molecular chlorine. As soon as the sun hits that, chlorine atoms are formed. That reacts with ozone to make chlorine monoxide. Now the chlorine has been activated for ozone loss. I like to describe this sometimes as being kind of like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and the clouds are sort of the potion that makes the chlorine into something much more damaging than it would otherwise be. That matters a lot because if you look at the ozone distribution as a function of altitude, most of it is located, as we know, in an ozone layer in the stratosphere, so most of it is between about 10 and 30 kilometers, as I've sketched there in this cartoon. If you only have gas phase chemistry working, all you can do is nibble away at the neck of the ozone layer, and that's why you only get something like a 5 to 10% depletion in a century. But if you have polar stratospheric clouds present, you can have much more ozone destruction right in the heart of the ozone layer. We know this from direct measurements. Here's a photo of my colleague Dave Hoffman and his team launching a balloon in Antarctica in 1986. And the type of thing that they see is indicated here. If you look at Antarctic ozone in August, it looks something like the blue line. By early September, it's already starting to drop. By late September, in the heart of the layer, it's dropped tremendously. And by early October, nowadays, it's essentially completely gone. So there's a region of total removal of ozone just in the height range where the polar stratospheric clouds are, between about 15 and 23 kilometers. So it's really quite an amazing change, quite a strong signature in altitude, which is important for explaining to people in simple ways how it is that we can be so confident about this chemistry. Well, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this slide. These are just the concurrent measurements of chlorine monoxide. It's been measured by several different techniques, independent measurements by microwave absorption and also by resonance fluorescence. And so you look at that sort of data and you can see that there's about 100 times more chlorine monoxide, exactly again in that key height range between 12 and 24 kilometers. It's been tremendously enhanced over what gas phase chemistry would suggest. At those kinds of levels, you can destroy about 2 to 3% of the ozone per day. So within about 5 to 7 weeks, the ozone will be completely gone. Well, in addition to all of that lovely data, we also have aircraft flights that were done by NASA in August to September of 1987, and these showed that as they flew south from Chile into the Antarctic, they saw the chlorine monoxide shoot up tremendously. You can see it increasing there, and the ozone concurrently dropping in the springtime. That's just a picture of myself and my colleagues on the roof of our lab in Antarctica, and it's to remind me to just say how tremendous the collaboration actually was and the leadership shown by the National Science Foundation in being able to get us to Antarctica quickly was amazing. The support staff from, at that time, ITT, Antarctic Services, and the Navy was phenomenal. It took a village to make this issue advance the way it has. We made measurements in 86 of chlorine monoxide. Chlorine dioxide is a molecule that my own group measured. Nitric oxide, NO2, HCl, the whole host of chemistry, the whole zoo of chemistry. And it all showed the same thing, that there were massive perturbations to the chemistry of the Antarctic and that they were quite capable of depleting the ozone layer as we had seen. Let me talk a little bit briefly about the Arctic versus the Antarctic. This just shows you the places where data has been taken. And as you can imagine, there are more places where data has been taken on ozone in the Arctic than the Antarctic. But sadly, the records in the Antarctic are actually more systematic and complete than those of the Arctic. It's a legacy of the Antarctic Treaty that we have long-term data going back to the IGY at many different stations. In the Arctic, we have sort of a patchwork quilt of data here, data there, data for 10 years, then no more data, et cetera. And this has been an enormous benefit to global environmental decision-making. So if the world is now going to think about global environmental decision-making on climate, it certainly would behoove it to think about what it would take to have a comparably complete set of data for the Arctic. It's not obvious to me that we'll get it without a similar sort of organizing principle. If you have a look at the data for Antarctica, that's just showing you now the daily measurements in September from the whole host of Antarctic stations. And you can see the completeness of the record at Faraday, at Halley Bay, at Shoa, also at the South Pole. There are also scattered data here and there from places that operated only for a short time. If you have a look at the Arctic, well, there's less depletion of Arctic ozone. And sadly, the records are, as I say, quite disjointed. The only really good continuous record in the true high Arctic going all the way back is from Resolute in Canada. There's data from some other places that's, you know, as I said, somewhat broken. But in any case, it's illustrative of the issue. I guess I should also say, just to emphasize, it's very clear that the Arctic ozone depletion, while significant, is much less dramatic than what happens in the much colder Antarctica. It's primarily just a difference of the temperature because that cold temperature, polar stratospheric cloud chemistry is so important. So from the perspective of science, what we have is evidence for understanding the fingerprint of ozone as a function of latitude, altitude, and season. Those iconic images of the ozone hole have had tremendous value in explaining to people what it is we know and don't know. And we are beginning to get that same kind of level of information now for the climate problem as well, but it hasn't, it's clear, reached that level of simplicity, if you will. The chemistry is well understood. I've already talked about that. We can do the linkages between the ozone hole and the CFCs in just one season of measurements. It's wonderful that we have the historical data from Antarctica, but if we didn't have it, we could go down there today and take measurements, and we would see the ozone depletion now just as we did back then. In the case of climate change, it's much more tough to be sure of calibrations going way back. We have such confidence, but it's obviously more difficult. From a practical perspective, the danger of things like cancer is very personal. And the issues relating to climate change, frankly, are for many people just much less easy to understand. The substitutes for CFCs are available, and it's pretty clear that whenever you talk about safety issues that involve the chemical industry, people have a broad understanding of that. We face such issues in smog. We face them in water quality. We have a framework for understanding that easily. Well, the nations of the world met in 1987 in Montreal and decided to freeze and then phase out CFC emissions. They met progressively at later meetings, making the restrictions more and more comprehensive. And so you can see what would have happened to chlorine if we'd had no protocol, what would have happened if we'd only done the initial agreement in Montreal and the stepwise approach to what we have now, which is essentially very close to zero emissions. So the ozone layer will recover, but it will take many decades to do so because the lifetimes of the gases themselves are very long. I just want to spend a minute giving you what I'm starting to call Susan's quiz. I've started doing this every time I talk about ozone these days because it's a lot of fun for people. Just contemplate this slide and think about who you might imagine back in 1987 in Montreal. Who was Government X who was skeptical about the theory and said, oh, this won't be harmful? Think about who Government X might have been. Government Y was kind of similar. Government Z was the one who, with its allies, came into every meeting and said, we must have targets. We must have timetables. Well, you know, if you're under 30, you're probably going to guess completely wrong. If you're over 30, you might remember that it was the UK that was the most skeptical. The European Commission, based primarily on the input of France and Germany, also followed the UK. It was the United States government and its allies, which included Sweden, Norway, and Canada, who came into the meetings and argued for a legally binding control protocol. And there's a wonderful book about this called Ozone Diplomacy by Richard Benedict, which I really recommend you read. It's quite a fascinating book to read. Why did this happen? Well, what I'm showing you here is the production of chlorofluorocarbons over time, the world total, what was produced in the United States, what was produced in the rest of the world. And what you can see there was that beginning around 1974, sales in the U.S. began dropping precipitously. They actually continued to rise in the rest of the world, mainly Europe and Japan to a lesser extent. The reason that it dropped in the United States was actually pretty interesting. It's because people in America decided to give up spray cans. They understood the issue. Even though it was only a theory, it was enough to energize the American population to make a personal choice to give up spray cans. That then meant that the chemical industry was now dealing with something which had been a great growth industry and had suddenly become a liability. They weren't able to sell as much as they could make because people weren't buying spray cans. They were buying roll-on deodorant instead. I mean, imagine that. That put a tremendous pressure on chemical industry, and it was pivotal in the decisions that followed. So my message here is simply to tell you that the most important step, in my view, of any environmental issue is public understanding. The people's choices are incredible in this kind of a problem, and I think it's clear that in the U.S. we made some useful and important choices that helped the ozone layer. Well, I don't want to overrun my time. Actually, I'm not overrunning my time, but my reduced time that this little red light is giving me. So let me ask the organizers, how much more time may I have? Paul, 5 minutes, 10 minutes? Okay. Let me talk then quickly about the benefits that the Montreal Protocol has given to climate change. What I'm showing you there are the emissions of carbon dioxide in gigatons of CO2, not gigatons of C, but gigatons of CO2 per year is the red curve. And as you can see, it ramped up to something like about 30 gigatons of carbon dioxide per year now. The Kyoto Protocol's reduction target is 2 gigatons of CO2 equivalent. At the time that the, so there's CO2 emissions. At the time that the Montreal Protocol was signed, you've got the ramp that was occurring there. And, of course, the thing that led so many nations to sign it and then ratify it and turn it into something effective certainly had a lot to do with Antarctica, which we're here celebrating today. Without that, I would argue that the world probably would have followed the blue line in terms of CFC emissions. So the black and blue lines are the CFC emissions. What that means is that the Montreal Protocol has today avoided 11 gigatons of CO2 equivalent that would have otherwise probably occurred by now. And that's about 5 to 6 times the Kyoto target, which is only 2. So 2 times 5 is 10. What this means, then, is that the Montreal Protocol has done far more for the climate system thus far than Kyoto ever did, and we should be celebrating that, I think, here, too. A new issue is now under consideration, which is how to reduce emissions of HFC substitutes for the CFCs, and the parties are beginning to grapple with that issue under Montreal. Well, I don't want to talk too much about the Antarctic climate. That's a whole other talk. But I will just say that the meteorology, the circulation pattern in Antarctica can be described as a vortex, very much like the vortex in your bathtub. The ozone hole has made the vortex colder and tighter. And I think Steve Rintoul later on will talk more about this. But that has actually stretched all the way down to the ground. And if you have a look at temperature measurements around the continent, what you can see is very interesting. The lower curve there shows you the change in the westerlies. The westerlies have strengthened as that spinning vortex has become colder and rounder, if you want to think of it that way. That has enhanced the warming in the peninsula region. It's a key factor in why we see this tremendous warming on the peninsula. Well, I'm out of time, but I do want to spend just a minute. No talk by Susan Solomon would be complete without some kind of statement about polar history. The Belgian Antarctic expedition, I really enjoyed Cornelia's talk yesterday. It was just absolutely incredible on the issue of polar history. The Belgian Antarctic expedition was the first to winter over. They didn't plan on that. They got frozen in. They had an amazing crew, which included this guy. And I love reading his comments. Actually, they're much more expressive than Amundsen became later in his life. I really recommend that you have a look at his diary there. Another person who was on board was that man, and he was the doctor. He's the one who realized they needed to be eating fresh meat, even though they didn't really understand scurvy, but it was probably his finest hour as a polar explorer. This guy is somebody you may not know, Arctowski. He made the daily med observations together with Lieutenant Danko, who was the one person who died during the expedition. The observations were demanding. They wore him out, and he just wanted to have some meat, some eggs, some milk. They all crave fresh food. He was a Pole. And after the expedition, he returned to Poland. In 1939, he was at a scientific meeting on climate in Washington, right here, when the war began. He stayed in the U.S. and continued to work as a scientist, and he worked right here at the Smithsonian Institution. Well, those are his measurements of temperature on board the Belgica during their winter drift. What he noticed was that the wind was very important in determining what the temperatures would be. When the wind was from the continent, it was very cold. When it was from the ocean, it was much warmer. And what this can be linked, actually, it's been an inspiration for me in my recent work, which, by the way, involved data from Orcadas, was the main focus from the Argentine station, together with scientists from the University of Buenos Aires. We have stronger westerlies now. We have fewer cold excursions. We have a warmer peninsula climate due, in large part in the summer at least, to ozone depletion. He probably was the first person to see polar stratospheric clouds. And just those are some of the points that Paul asked the people in this panel to think about. And I think it's quite amazing when you look at the ozone issue to realize that they hit so many of his of the points that Paul identified as key for this meeting here today. So thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much, Dr. Solomon. And on behalf of the board, I will give you the medal
thank you.
For your kind presentation.